Chapter 15. The Decision Revisited. Pigs get fed and hogs get slaughtered. You get what you can, and then you get what you want. Representative Becky Kelso. May 10th to 17th, 1991. This was the third year the Senate had passed chartering legislation, and it was the third year of debating chartering in conference committee. Finally, in May 1991, we seemed to have the necessary votes, 5 Senate conferees and 3 House conferees, to adopt the chartering language as originally intended. But more likely, the language would be compromised in some way. As long as a provision is in either the House bill or the Senate bill, it is in play for amendment and final passage. Compromise in a conference committee can take many forms. Sometimes compromise means the creation of a package deal, in which each House gets its top policy or budget priorities by accepting the top priorities of the other House. And sometimes compromise means finding an acceptable middle ground on a particular provision between the positions of the two houses. If chartered schools were to have the autonomy necessary to succeed, only a little middle ground was left on its provisions. At least that was the view of chartering supporters. As bill author, I had already yielded to 2 top priority requests made by the teacher unions: eliminating post-secondary institutions as sponsors, and ensuring that all teachers in chartered schools would be licensed. Of course, more compromises were possible, as supportive House conferees still had to ensure the provisions could pass the House even after they were accepted in committee. But I was not anticipating compromises on the fundamental features of the bill. To me, the most important features were the following. First, allowing a separate bargaining unit for teachers in a chartered school. Second, having the Minnesota State Board of Education serve as an alternative sponsor to the local district school board. Without the alternative of the state board as a sponsor, a local school board would have no incentive to approve a chartered school, even if a community strongly supported a new school. In my view, it meant Minnesota would have no chartered schools. Some education groups maintained that a school sponsored by any entity other than a school board would not be a public school. My response? The issue depended on whether the school would follow the 3 principles of public education. First, that it be non-selective. Second, that it not charge tuition. Third, that it be accountable to public authority for public objectives. As Ted Koldery wrote around this time, "What's giving way is the old notion that the character of the purpose is defined by the character of the agent. Many, if not most, systems already operate on a different principle. Nobody, for example, would define a road as a private road because it's built by a private contractor. A road is a public road if there is a public decision to build it, if the public sets the specifications, if it is paid for with public funds, and if it is open to the public for travel." In this, as in so many things, education has simply been slow to follow, continuing to insist that public education is and is only the traditional public school. By now, the general opposition against the chartering bill had grown to a fever pitch within the teacher unions and other education groups. The pressure was enormous on all House DFLers, most of whom the teacher unions had backed in the election 6 months before. The unions were now urging House members to tell their conferees to reject the chartering bill. And I suspected no one was feeling the pressure more than Representative Ken Nelson. He was the key legislator who would shape any amendments to the chartering language in the conference committee. He also seemed to be the number one union target, and for good reason. Nelson had been instrumental in getting the chartering legislation to this point. He had authored the early legislation in the House in 1989 and 1990. But I speculated that as the unions became more sharply aggressive, he had to listen. He was, after all, the chair of the House Education Finance Division, and his DFL caucus members were counting on him to make the right choices on their behalf for policy and politics. If unions were displeased, they could adversely affect how much financial and volunteer support union members would provide the caucus and its individual candidates in the 1992 election. I also understood what politics Nelson could personally face. He was a legislator from South Minneapolis, a liberal DFL stronghold. The real threat to an incumbent in such a district is a strong opponent for DFL party endorsement. Unions, of course, were often key to winning DFL endorsement and party primaries. A union-backed opponent against Nelson in the next election was a real possibility. While he was well-respected in his district and at the Capitol, and could likely overcome such a threat, the battle could get emotionally brutal. No candidate looks forward to that. In her 2011 interview, Louise Sundin confirmed that the unions were in conversations with Nelson about chartering. When asked whether the unions threatened to back another DFL opponent in the next election, she replied, "Oh, no, we wouldn't threaten out loud. We were in the background, grooming somebody else for the spot." The MFT had begun talking with DFL Representative Myron Orfield, who had been elected in 1990 in a neighboring legislative district. After redistricting lines were drawn from the 1990 census, Nelson and Orfield ended up in the same legislative district for the 1992 election cycle. In a 2011 phone call, Orfield confirmed he would have run against Nelson in the DFL primary election. Sundin acknowledged that the union pressure on Nelson was significant because, of course, we knew Ken pretty well. Being a Minneapolis legislator, we interacted with him a lot and expected a lot. I think we just thought he'd gone a bridge too far. On his end, Nelson recalled in his interview how close he was to the teacher unions and how they aggressively opposed chartering. "Not only did Louise Sundin live in my district, but so did MFT lobbyist Rose Hermanson. Rose was particularly active in my campaign. She had chaired one of the precincts and always got literature out very diligently. When you're chair of the finance division, you get the union's attention. I delivered as much as I could for urban districts and for K-12. One of Nelson's most difficult encounters with the unions was when Representative Bob McCarron brought Hermanson to a private meeting with some conferees during final negotiations. Nelson explained, "We were meeting in one of the rooms at the Capitol. It was not a large meeting room, and I don't know how public it was or if this was just an effort between House and Senate to knock heads again and come to agreement. But what McCarron did was bring in Rose Hermanson to speak against chartering to House and Senate conferees. It was totally inappropriate to have a lobbyist come into a conference committee like that. I think it was one of those meetings where you try to get things focused apart from the public eye. It really put pressure on me because she was not only the lobbyist for MFT, but active in my district." "I knew none of this at the time. I speculated Nelson was getting union pressure, but I was unaware of the detailed negotiations." Here's another significant factor unknown to me and everyone else. Nelson had made the decision in 1990 to not seek re-election at the end of his 2-year term. But he would not announce his retirement until the spring of 1992. Here's how he put it in his interview. "The next 2 years were going to be my last. That would wrap up 20 years. Reapportionment was coming up. By that time, I was tired of campaigning 10 races. I just wanted to try something else. I received a Bush Fellowship and was able to go to Harvard for some graduate work. In some ways, it might have given me more freedom to act in support of chartering because I wasn't going to run in 92. If I had decided to run again, the unions would have had more influence on me. I suppose I have to honestly say that. On the other hand, it kind of angered me the way they took me on, and that made me a little bit stubborn. I thought, I'm going to see that this gets passed, the charter school bill. All I've done for the teachers over the years, and then they turn on me over one issue? I was a little upset with that. I thought that was unfair." For Nelson, seeing that the chartering bill got passed meant making some compromises. It wasn't long before I was hearing from Coldery and others that Nelson was considering making a significant amendment to the legislation before he would support it in the conference committee. I heard he was in conversation with the unions, his colleagues, and others. No one knew what amendment he would propose, but we all knew it would likely be the final legislation. MFT President Sandra Peterson recalled working with Nelson on the amendment. Ken was very good to work with because he would try to find places to compromise. He was really looking at reform in kind of a bigger picture. I do think we tried to modify the language the best we could so that it would at least be a little bit of salvo to our members who were so concerned. These were our friends who were working on this. You try to work with your friends. Even though we didn't like everything, we were trying to work with them and get the best deal. With compromise in the wings, the question now became, what's critical and what's not for successful chartered schools? Chartering supporters went into action to devise compromise amendments that would not totally undermine the legislation. As Coldery wrote in his May 11, 1991 memo to me, and I quote, "What's critical? Everybody, and this includes emphatically the teachers who are so interested in the idea getting enacted, agrees on these. First, the state board as alternate sponsor, the only one that counts. The upfront exemption from the rules. Second, the separate bargaining unit for teachers. The killer amendment. At some point, someone will surely offer to let a provision with the charter school's title go through if the authors will agree, A, to limit the sponsor to the local board, and B, to agree that no significant number of charters could be issued. That isn't worth having." I couldn't agree more. Yet I had to step back and give Nelson the space he needed. All I could do was offer ideas through colleagues and through Coldery. Three main compromises seemed to be under discussion. The first was to limit the total number of charters granted by all sponsors. I thought something between 10 and 25 would be a reasonable cap to allow diversity geographically and in curriculum. The second area of compromise was a right of first refusal. Charter organizers would first work with the local school board to come to an agreement. If an agreement was not possible, the charter applicants would have the right to look elsewhere for a sponsor. To me, this was superior to another proposal in which charter applicants would first have to be turned down by the local school board before they could approach another sponsor. As Coldery described in his May 11th memo, "Nothing would come of putting the organizers of a school in the position of having to take to the state board a proposal with a big stamp on the cover, rejected by the local board." When someone gets the right of first refusal, they don't get the right to dictate the terms of the agreement. They get a chance to meet your terms before you make the deal with somebody else. The third main area of compromise seemed to be bubbling up from the teacher unions. They wanted teachers to be in charge of a chartered school. At the time, I wasn't sure what that meant, though it would later become an important point. By now, I had to accept that some significant changes would be made to the fundamentals of the Senate chartering bill. I want to be honest here. Letting go of the original vision of chartered schools wasn't easy for me. The road to passage had been long, and the end seemed so close. I was already deeply disappointed. Moreover, I was angry with the leadership of the teacher unions. What disturbed me most were the mistruths they were circulating about the legislation and my supportive colleagues. To the unions, we were now union busters, voucher lovers, and anti-public education. We would destroy public education as we know it. We would drain scarce dollars from already struggling school districts, never mind that those dollars would instead directly follow the individual student the public funding was supposed to support. Forgotten in all this, it seemed, were the new opportunities we could create for students, their families, their communities, and yes, even teachers. The teacher unions were equally disappointed in how the compromise was playing out. according to Sundin in her 2011 interview. There was not much interest in interacting with Koldery and the other reformers because there was no compromise with them and they didn't really understand or support union teachers' issues. They didn't seem to be willing to go far enough in their compromise to allow collective bargaining and to protect teachers in charter schools. They'd tinker around the edges, but they didn't seem willing to go, obviously, as far as we wanted them to go. And the unions were not happy with me, personally. As Sundin said, Barry Nowak and Robbinsdale Federation of Teachers weren't happy about Ember's role, but wanted to try to maintain a civil relationship because she was their senator. The state MFT as a whole did not want to support Senator Reichscott, and this carried over into later races. There was very little support for her within the state MFT, primarily because of her role in pushing charter legislation. Members did not trust her, nor feel that she in any way understood unionism. I think there was kind of a feeling, and I might be reading too much into this, that she was kind of a limousine liberal from the burbs and not enough of a hardcore blue-collar unionist from the city or the Iron Range. MFT President Peterson, my constituent, had this to say in her interview. We were upset with Ember in particular, I can tell you that, because she was the leading force on this. It was hard for me because she was from our district, and I supported her as a legislator and continued to support her, but we were very frustrated with her. There was no moving on this. Ember was like, this is the way it's going to be. Sandy tapped her finger against the table for emphasis. She certainly tried to work with people, but she was definitely the leader here. Ember could influence, and she did. I didn't like everything she was doing, but I learned a long time ago that you separate what you're doing over here in policy. You try to do the best you can. I've never let that stand in the way of supporting Ember in later races. People are going to promote things, and I think it's sad if you let that get in the way. Obviously, it wasn't an easy time. Tensions were building and relationships were strained. As I waited to hear the elements of Nelson's amendment, I had an uneasy feeling in the pit of my stomach. I don't remember who finally told me. I don't think it was Nelson himself. I just remember my reaction. I burst into tears. To me, the battle was over. Nelson was drafting an amendment with three elements. First, a chartered school must be approved by both the local school district and the Minnesota State Board of Education. There were no alternate sponsors. Second, only 8 chartered schools would be allowed in the entire state. A single school board could approve no more than 2. Third, only licensed teachers could form and operate a chartered school. A majority of the chartered school's board of directors would have to be licensed teachers employed at the school. I was stunned. Never, in my worst scenarios, did I imagine that a chartered school would need double approval by both the local school district and the state board. Never did I imagine that only teachers could start a chartered school. What about parents? As an attorney, I couldn't fathom how a board made up of a majority of teachers could govern a school. Not only did that limit the size of the board and limit outside financial and other expertise, but it was also, in my view as an attorney, an outright conflict of interest. Nelson, of course, had a different view about the amendment as related in his 2011 interview. It wasn't going to kill it. It was actually to keep it alive. And I think it really helped to keep it alive. I thought the one amendment with the teachers in charge was a good one. It was the original Shanker vision. But also, why not? It just seemed to me teachers knew best. We limited it to 8 schools, and I thought that was enough for a trial run. And approval by the local board and the state board? We knew the state board would do it. And then the local board? You didn't want the local board fighting everything. I felt, let's get their approval in hopes they wouldn't stop a charter application. Some key chartering supporters in the legislature saw Nelson's amendment as progress. Senator Ron Dicklich had put chartered schools on the line long ago as a must-have in his negotiations. The Meadowland School, detailed in Chapter 10, continued to be his motivation. In his 2011 interview, Dicklich said, "The House was going to fight me to the end. I had a number of things I wanted. I told Bob McCarran and Ken Nelson, who was favorable to charter schools, here are six things I want. Give me six things you want and call me, because we're not meeting again until I get those six things." So, when Nelson came to Dicklich with his proposed amendment, here's what Dicklich thought. "To me, that showed there was movement, that they were going to accept this thing. He wouldn't have brought that to me without checking with his people, because he had to have three votes for it. That showed me they were going to take our charter school language." Ken said to just limit it to eight. "I thought about it. So, I pretended I went and talked to members, but I didn't. If they said no, then what was I going to do? I remember Ember questioning it, and I said, 'Ember, do you want this thing or not? 3 years you've been here. If you don't make it this year, you'll probably never make it. Things only have a shelf life. Let's get it. We'll go after more in future years.'" Dicklich also liked the go-slow approach of the amendment. "I just wanted to get charter schools started. I was interested in one. I wasn't going to hold this thing up and have them stalemate it because I wasn't willing to just take eight schools. That's my feeling. Let's look and see how things are. Let's not do something that may be detrimental to kids and their education. It kind of goes along with my philosophy." Dicklich added, "Pigs get fed and hogs get slaughtered." Representative Becky Kelso also supported the compromise amendment. "To me, the narrowing was not a bad thing," she said in 2011. "I thought it was a reasonable way to start. You get what you can, and then you get what you want. As for me, all I knew was, this was it. Either this amendment or nothing." But it was indeed, as Coldery had written me, a killer amendment. With just days left in the session, no more options remained. Coldery, the Citizens League Working Group, and other chartering supporters hated the amendment just as much as I did, but we had nowhere else to turn for help. I wondered, was this the point where we tell the House conferees that we wanted to lay the bill over for yet another session? How can we pass a bill with the name Chartered School when it is destined to fail? Do we pass a bill intended to create chartered schools that doesn't allow real opportunity for them to be created? Do we pass a bill that allows critics to say in coming years, see, no one really wanted to create any chartered schools? In 18 years as a state legislator, I made thousands of split-second decisions. None would ever have the impact of this one. Instinctively, I decided we had to take the amendment and go with it. I knew this legislation would get harder to pass, not easier. The unions were now at full roar. Some of my colleagues had been viciously attacked. With heavy heart, I wrote a short note to my five Senate colleagues on the conference committee. "Dear colleagues, you've been great. I really appreciate your strong and heartfelt support. Ken's comfort level amendment is being drafted. It includes double approval, eight pilots up to two by one district. Only licensed teachers can create the charter school. If you can change anything, try to change the last one, so other educators, parents, etc. can form the charter school and hire licensed teachers. That's how our bill reads now. Thanks, Ember." As I watched the final action of the conference committee from the audience, I was completely drained. Nelson presented his amendment. The amendment was adopted on divided vote. Three senators and three House members voted in favor. Two of five senators were absent. Their votes weren't needed. Chartered schools had been the last provision to be resolved. So the conference committee's meetings were over. I didn't want to stick around because I knew my emotions were out of control. I stood up and walked out of the hearing room into the hallway, talking to no one. It was in the hallway that I heard one teacher union lobbyist say confidently to the other, "Don't worry, we have the votes to kill it on the House floor." As meaningless as the amended bill seemed to me, I couldn't believe the teacher unions were still pulling out the stops. The next battleground was now the 134 members of the Minnesota House of Representatives. 79 of them were DFLers, 55 Republicans. We had one day. No one would bet on the outcome.